Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Hi. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. And by the way, the club is online at commonwealthclub.org, as well as on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. I'm Scott Schaefer, Senior Editor for Politics at KQED, and now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. Mayor Garcetti is the 42nd mayor of Los Angeles, first elected in 2013. He was the youngest person elected mayor at age 42, reelected last year with 81% of the vote. Under his watch, he recently spearheaded passage of the nation's largest local infrastructure plan, the $120 billion Measure M, which is aimed at transforming transit in Los Angeles, trying to get people out of their cars. Garcetti is chair of the U.S. Conference of Mayors Infrastructure Task Force. He's also co-chair of the Mayor's National Climate Action Agenda, which, by the way, organized U.S. mayors to commit to the goals of the Paris Accord after President Trump withdrew from that. And he is apparently exploring a run for president. We're going to talk to him about that and a whole bunch of other things. Please welcome Mayor Garcetti.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you.
So, I even see a Dodger cap out there. So I just want you guys to know I root for the Warriors when the Lakers and Clippers are out of it. So I hope in the playoffs we'll get some Dodger fans up here.
Yeah, you guys got LeBron now.
That's a tougher sell, I think, in San Francisco than anything else.
So, you know, California's a big state, and we up here in the Bay Area are sometimes a little parochial. So
yes.
Why don't you, like, give us your speech. Who are you? You know, when you go, you come here and you talk to folks, or you go to, say, Iowa or New Hampshire, Sure. Like, who's Eric Garcetti?
Well, I think I'm kind of an average American in the sense that none of us are average. We, you know, have an Italian last name. I'm half Mexican, half Jewish. If you can't get elected with that, who can? I think I'm part of this kind of braided country that we have, somebody who really loves California and really embodies, I think, that distillation of American values that is California, that we value freedom, that we value the future, and that we have a sense that everybody belongs. You know, we always have these words like inclusion and diversity and tolerance. If you want to know me, I think I've always felt a strong sense of belonging to this state, to my city, and to this country, whether it's in military service, whether it's in public service, or just the idea that we're all kind of boundary crossers and that we are at our best when we're trying to find the common ground between each other at a moment, especially in politics, when everything is about how we can be divided. But I've always been, you know, I'm a musician. I'm somebody who loves creativity. I think that's part of California, too. My two grandparents on my mom's side met in the Eastman School of Music as piano students, you know, grandson of immigrants. And really, in some ways, I think the differences in me people could see as contradictions. I see them just as part of who I am. That I very comfortably have always been that boundary crosser. People figured I was Italian, so I'd hear anti-Semitic or anti-Latino jokes, so I'd know kind of as an outsider what it felt like, but I'd also be an insider coming into those communities. And whether it's the time that I spent in the Navy or time that I've spent abroad, I've loved kind of exploring what America is, both in the literal sense and in the symbolic sense, because I think America has represented something so important to this world. And as a mayor, I think the last thing you need to know about me is I'm a mayor. And I really proudly embrace that at a time when politics is about not getting much done, but just tweeting and counter-tweeting. Mayors are involved and city government is involved in really hard work. And I think it's the hard work that Americans want in government. And so I'm pretty convinced this is probably the best job you can ever have in politics. It's one of the most demanding things you can ever do.
Well, you're so close to the people, you know.
Absolutely.
The more you climb the rung, the further away you are.
There's a great quote from my dear friend Mitch Landrieu, who was the former mayor is the former mayor of New Orleans. Remember when Jeff Flake was confronted by a survivor of sexual violence last week and really kind of threw him for a loop, it sounded like, and made him maybe change some of his thinking. And he was asked about that. He said, for a mayor, that's 8 times or 9 times on the way to get milk at the grocery store. We know that, and there's an intimacy to, you know, you've had people yell at you, you've had people cry in your arms, you've had people hug you, you know, at their high moments, at their low moments. And I love that because You know, it's easy to love humanity. The difficult work is learning to embrace your neighbor.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your heritage because it is an interesting mix. Sure. So on your mom's side, they were Ukrainian immigrants, I think?
Ukrainian, Polish, Russian, all that, Belarus, all the areas of the Russian Empire at that time, Jews that were living in what was in the Russian Empire, but as far west as Poland, as far east as Russia.
And then your dad's side was from Mexico.
Correct.
And your great-grandfather, I think, was...
We don't know that. There's obviously the Mexican, somebody in the male line was of Italian instead of Spanish descent. We could have been a great-grandfather or great-great-father. We're not sure because my great-grandfather was killed in the Mexican Revolution. My grandfather, Salvador, who is the newest immigrant in my family to this country, 100 years ago was carried over the border in my great-grandmother's arms as a baby. So, you know, the resonance of this year as children were being literally ripped out of their parents' arms. And I went down to the border with a group of mayors, both Democrat and Republican, who went down there at the same, basically, border crossing where my grandfather was at. And it hit me very hard that was, you know, life would have been different had policies back then been the same that they were right now. But he was a war refugee, a dreamer, only got his citizenship when he volunteered in World War II to leave two young kids behind, fight for this country, and came back and became a citizen.
So you're fluent in Spanish also?
Pretty fluent. I can speak pretty fluently, you know. It's an important part of my job. And I learned from my grandparents, who's both of their first language. My grandmother was born in the United States, but her parents were from Mexico. She was one of 18 children to the same two parents, by the way. Everybody always asks if there are multiple parents. A very good Catholic Mexican-American family in Arizona.
I'm exhausted just thinking about that.
And my great-grandmother was done at, I think, 38. So if you do that math, I mean, she was essentially pregnant from late teens to 38 and had 18 kids.
So can you say your Jewish prayers in Spanish?
That's the real question. I often joke I'm Ladino, you know, a mix of Latino and or Jutino. But no, I cannot do my Jewish prayers in Spanish. I'll work on that.
So obviously immigration is personal for you, and it's been such a huge issue in California. I think, I forget the exact number, but more than a third of people who live here are from somewhere else, okay. I think. Maybe it's a quarter, but it's a big number. Part of the criticism, and Republicans always try to distinguish between legal and illegal immigration. They say, oh, love immigrants, but they have to come here in the quote-unquote right way. What's your reaction to that? Because they're not the only ones that feel that way, and some immigrants who did come here legally feel that way.
I think it's the wrong frame. I think we need to set goals as a country as to what kind of goals we want for immigration. Low skill, high skill, families that stay together. It's been a much blurrier line over history. I have no idea whether my grandfather was, quote, documented or undocumented, legal or illegal. The border was a different place. We have a border crossing card from a second time when he crossed. I think he was 7. But who knows? I mean, my grandmother... great-grandmother just did what a mother did when she lost her husband in that war, had a baby, she picked him up and started walking. And, you know, it's one of the great competitive advantages of this country, our immigration. It always has been. We don't have the best and the brightest in India and in Indonesia and in places around the world trying to get into China to start new businesses or to get their education. But we do have that here in the United States. Of course we need secure borders. Any country does. But it's the wrong question to talk about illegal or legal because that's really, you know, what is in any given time legal or illegal? And for us, I think you then go back to the last time Congress screwed up making the laws to decide what today is either legal or illegal instead of proactively saying, what do we collectively as a nation want for the next 30 years? Do we want families to be split up? Do we want, in my city where 61% of the businesses are started by immigrants, many of them undocumented, to lose that momentum? And the statistic you give, if you go back a generation in Los Angeles, 63% of us are either are immigrants or the children of immigrants. So it's a hugely blended thing. You know, you don't have peep families where if somebody's quote unquote illegal, but somebody else is legal, shouldn't we be talking about family unity first?
You know, there have been, over the past few years, different attempts to compromise on immigration. George W. Bush tried it, John McCain, some Democrats as well were part of that. The most recent sort of deal that didn't happen was the wall for Dreamers. You know, let's take care of the Dreamers, but in exchange, we'll fund the wall. I'm wondering if, you know, what do you think, what should Democrats be willing to concede or at least talk about? For example, there's talk of maybe we should lower the overall rate of legal immigration and maybe focus on who, like you said, who do we want in this country in terms of skills? What do we need in terms of skills? Most countries in the world already do that. Is that something that should be put on the table?
I think the most important thing first is to deal with folks that are here. You know, in Southern California, we've got 2 million people who are undocumented. 2 million. We've got 400 ICE agents. You know, even if the president wants to increase that by 50% to 600, do the math. We've got a challenge to resolve right here, right now, even before we start looking to the future. And we all know that native-born folks have their wages depressed if people are kept in the shadows. I mean, it's logical, right? Somebody can work for less than minimum wage, no protections, and that drags down wages, drags down worker protections. When we figure out a path to citizenship for all of those folks who, you know, save violent, dangerous criminals who we should be getting out of the streets of Los Angeles, San Francisco, whatever, we then have a pathway towards greater prosperity, greater engagement. We saw that with the Dreamers, who are just one class of folks. But the Dreamers, when they had legal status, we all got a raise. They certainly got the most dramatic one. They could use their college degrees. The straight-A student suddenly could go work at an architect's office, could buy, you know, I've talked to Dreamers who bought their parents' cars, started investing in their first house. I mean, they invest in the American dream. They help California and the nation be prosperous. So I think that's first and foremost. Second, I don't like holding one aspect of immigrants hostage for another. You know, we always negotiate against ourselves as Democrats. Republicans and this president said that they would take care of the Dreamers, don't worry, full stop. And then they added other things to this and started saying, oh, you guys are holding up the Dreamers. No, they added the wall. They added things. Just live up to your word. You've missed every deadline. You said it would get done by, you know, February of this year, then it would get done by March. They have not lived up to what they said they are going to do. So there is a consensus in this country around Dreamers. I think there's a consensus around in this country around agricultural workers. I think there's a consensus in this country around the high-skilled workers. And I still believe there's a consensus around family unity. I don't think we as Americans want to split up families. And even if you just are a fan of the high-skilled immigrants, you think people are going to come if their family can't? So let's be smart about this. Let's get that stuff together. And then we can talk about what are our future quotas and how do we keep a border secured.
You know, there were some who looked at the 2016 election and Hillary Clinton's campaign, which, you know, obviously fell short, although she got more votes, and felt like the starting from the slogan, you know, United Together, I think, or Stronger Together. Maybe that's the Warriors. I think it was Stronger. Anyway, the point being, some people, strength in numbers, that's the Warriors. Yeah. Some people felt that her campaign and the Democrats generally put too much emphasis on support for undocumented immigrants and immigrants more generally, and that others, white folks, white working class people, felt left out of that conversation, or that, you know, that she wasn't speaking to them in a way that, you know, Donald Trump was. I mean, what do you think of that?
I think that's been a trope since the campaign a lot. I think you have to be authentic, you have to be yourself, and it's okay to actually take stances that may not be in the mainstream. People are looking for leaders. But my analysis is more that Democrats and average people out there didn't feel that we were listening to them. You know, Make America Great Again is actually an aspirational slogan. We know in reality it excludes many of us. It is a nationalist vision which isn't inclusive of everybody. But at least it's about you. You're part of America. I want to make America great again. The initial slogan, and let's be clear, Hillary Clinton got more votes than Donald Trump did, but it was, I'm with her. I think to the average voter, if you talk about yourself, they say, oh, you're talking about yourself. If you talk about them, they say, oh, you're talking about me. And I've never won an election by talking. I've won elections by listening. Between elections, and one of the things I love doing as a mayor, is going door to door and just knocking on people's doors. And they're always like, I say it's the mayor. They're like, well, they say this nicely, BS. And then they open the door, they're like, you do kind of look like the mayor.
You do cold calls?
No, I walk a block or two or three, you know, on weekends with a group of folks, you know, offering to give help with programs the city has and just to listen. And by the time they actually recognize it's the mayor at the front door and they have worked out, I'm not running for anything. I don't need to vote. I'm not asking for anything. I just want them to talk to me and I'm just listening. It's a transformative moment. It breathes hope back into this democracy. And I think what I learned at that level is important for our presidents to know. Our Washington leadership doesn't listen. The Democratic Party kind of turned into the smarty pants party. We had an answer to everything. When people just want to be heard, they want you to understand they go through. I tell people when they come to work for me, there's a heart, head, and gut check. First of all, when you get to that front door, people want to see, are you a real person? Do you understand what I'm going through? Because life's tough. You might hear full unemployment, but I'm working three jobs and I don't see my kids. I'm one medical emergency away from bankruptcy. And if you can sympathize with them and connect with them that you understand that, they'll let you go to phase two, which is, okay, now do you have ideas? Do you have a head? What are you going to do to solve that? I don't expect government to solve everything, but I want you to show me you have an idea of what to do on healthcare or what to do. And then the third thing is the guts. You know, if you connect with me and if you have an idea, do you have the guts to actually do something about it? And what we saw in the presidential election was one candidate who I think most people knew didn't have the heart and the head as well as the other person, but who had the guts. And if you don't show that last piece, that you have the resolve to do something on immigration, that you'll take a risk, that you will on healthcare take a risk to get universal access to healthcare, that you will fight for the environment, that you'll do something, they're kind of going to dismiss you.
What's an example of something where you've taken a risk as mayor and really something where you maybe went against the grain, wasn't popular, wasn't going to win you votes necessarily?
You know, well, you all know in California we have to get a two-thirds vote. You mentioned it in the introduction. For 3 years, because like the Bay Area, we have a complicated political environment, and everybody loves to hate the L.A. mayor, right? We get 90% of the headlines, and we're 40% of the population in L.A. County. So every quarter I did something no mayor had done. I brought the other 87 mayors of L.A. County together, and every quarter we met. And I said, tell me what's going on in your city, what I can do to help you. So 3 years later, when we decided to go to the voters with the biggest infrastructure initiative in U.S. history, times two at the local level, a full cent sales tax for transportation, I basically put my entire political life on the line. And we had just lost one of those the year before I became mayor. So people didn't think it could get done. And I was willing to risk everything. I went to far reaches of L.A. County where people would yell at me and say, you know, this money's just going to go to L.A. City. It's not coming here. Where some people said, slow down, let's do it later. And we raised $10 million and passed something that will provide 787,000 jobs that we can't export out, that will build 15 rail lines and rapid transit lines in L.A. We did it with the minimum wage, which might sound like, oh, that's easy to raise the minimum wage. I had organized labor saying, no, this isn't the year to do it. We're going to do it. We'll do it 2 years from now. The business community saying, no, this is going to kill business. So I love taking those sorts of risks, making community college free, which folks said, well, you can't afford to do that. There's no way. And we boosted attendance from our public schools 40% this past year, going full time to community college. So, you know, there's plenty of moments in the past on very important issues, from immigration to transgender rights to the environment. But I really think it's those big things that are the biggest risks, because it's easy to do incremental. It's really tough to do big.
Yeah. One of the issues that's pressing down on mayors, certainly on you, on the mayor here, and has been for decades now, and now San Diego, Sacramento, is homelessness.
Absolutely.
And it was the first, second, and third issue on voters' minds in the last mayoral election. Is it something that mayors can solve?
I certainly think so. Although it's a great question, because most people never ask that. You're a unified county and city here in San Francisco, but in the city of LA, we don't have most of the tools to solve homelessness. Federal money comes in for housing or doesn't. It's been cut. State money was obliterated for affordable housing a few years ago with the end of redevelopment. And our county runs our hospital, our mental health, our foster care system, our veteran stuff. So all we have is cops and people can clean the streets, and neither of those are solutions to homelessness. But I took the bull by the horns and also brought the mayors of the big 11 cities in California together to really confront this, because it's not just in high rent areas like San Francisco or Los Angeles. It's in Fresno. It's in the Central Valley. We need a national conversation, first of all, on this, and I welcome that. A lot of people saying, oh, now that there's talk about you nationally, isn't homelessness going to be a big problem? I say, I would love a national conversation on housing and homelessness, because there's a mental health crisis in this country that if 10 of us got a broken leg and went to the emergency room, 10 of us would get service. But if 10 of us are addicted to heroin, maybe one of us can get help. That's not a healthcare system right now, and it's probably the result of mental health issues that we have. So in Los Angeles, we passed the two largest measures in U.S. history, again, one for housing and one for services, one for the county and one for our city, No jurisdiction's ever gotten as much resources at one time on this issue. It's still, in my opinion, maybe half of what we need. But I do believe that in this next decade in Los Angeles, we can end street homelessness. And we saw our first downtick this year just as the money's starting to come about. We're building 10,000 new units of permanent supportive housing, and we've hired 1,000 new people to hit the streets and to work on the issue. But it's a very, very most complicated public policy issue any of us will ever confront.
You mentioned the redevelopment agencies. Of course, Jerry Brown and the legislature eliminated those as part of the budget, you know, belt tightening in 2011. Was that a mistake?
It was. Absolutely. It was among the most important tools, especially around affordable housing. Yeah, I could point to some abuses in other places that people took this money that should be going to schools and roads and all of that and used it to help developers. But it was the best tool we had to build workforce and affordable housing. And cities have been decimated by that. You know, how did we get here? Homelessness is the result of trauma that's untreated and high rents, not enough housing. And yes, we have to build housing top down in the marketplace, but we have to subsidize it bottom up too. And redevelopment took that away.
You know, both candidates for mayor, John Cox and Gavin Newsom, are saying they're going to break all the records and build more housing than we've built since the 1960s. But there are some real obstacles to building more housing, not the least of which is local opposition.
Yep.
Do you think that, you know, cities and citizens, so to speak, have too much power to stop housing?
I think it's less citizens than sometimes the leaders in cities. Los Angeles, we're a great model. I set a goal that was the most ambitious in a few decades to build 100,000 units of housing in the 8 years I was hoping to be mayor. We're going to hit that 2 years early, we expect by the end of this fiscal year. And yet we look at that and we probably need to double that. We need the state help to get rid of some of the abuse of CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. It is so all these well-intentioned things that we've done as progressives or liberals, each stone in the backpack was really well-intended. And some of them need to stay there. But that backpack is so heavy now, it is so difficult
to move. What are some of the other stones?
I think, obviously, assembling land, the cost of land. And cities are rich. Cities have so much public land. When I look at, for instance, our metro in L.A. County, as we assemble the land for 15 new rail lines and rapid transit lines, we're going to be huge landowners. The temptation is just to sell that back to the highest bidder. We mandated 35% of that has to be subsidized low-income housing. Because if you displace people and gentrify them out of the very same neighborhood they've been waiting for transportation to come to, you've failed. That's more traffic, more pollution, less affordable housing. I also think that we have to find better building types. The technology revolution that we've seen that's primarily two-dimensional, using FaceTime or one-click ordering on Amazon, is now moving into the three-dimensional space. Transportation and cars, electric scooters, autonomous vehicles, even flying cars and things. But also in housing. That is an area that we need the brilliance of the Bay Area, hopefully folks down south too, to disrupt. To really be able to build, it's ridiculous that it takes $500,000 to build one unit of affordable housing. We are not going to build our way out of that at those prices. So we've been very aggressive in Los Angeles. We just opened up a project last week. It was $109,000 with prefab and building containers and other things like that. $109,000 for a nice apartment.
I think some people who are advocates of affordable housing would say that one of those stones in the backpack is the cost of labor and the demands, as you say, well-intentioned, but perhaps unaffordable or certainly adding to the cost of housing. So what should Democrats be asking their friends in labor to do to help more housing get built?
It is not that it's organized labor, because I think organized labor, and when it comes to building stuff, does the absolute best work. We spent a lot of time with the carpenters. I started a group called Accelerator for America to take these examples of brilliant things happening at the local level across America and transporting them to other cities. So we looked at our Measure M, and now we're helping, you know, a dozen plus cities, including the Bay Area, who's looking at a transportation measure, and we're advising and funding that to look at how they can get that passed. It's the supply of workers themselves. There's so much construction work. For instance, in Los Angeles, I'm spending $15 billion in my airport, $120 billion in public transportation, $3 billion at the port, which is the largest port in the Americas, and we can't find enough workers. This is a national issue and a great one. Only about 15% of this country works in manual labor, either in factories or construction trades. Factories can continue to be automated, and we have a an important role for manufacturing, but we're kind of overly nostalgic about that when we have plenty of job openings in construction, which is middle-class jobs with benefits, a living wage, but we need to align a national education system to get those electricians. And the carpenters who we work with, they spend $200 million a year without any taxpayer money on training their folks to use lasers, to be entrepreneurs, to really be the craftsmen and women of the future, which is what guilds once were. And I'm very passionate about local policies and a national vision of giving folks those skills, because I think that really is how we save the middle class in America.
You mentioned CEQA, and Governor Brown sort of flirted with the idea of reforming CEQA. There have been some major workarounds CEQA for stadiums, I think one or two of them in LA, for example. And some people see that and say, well, if we can do it for ballparks, why can't we do it for housing?
It's a travesty that we're doing it for folks who are, you know, billionaire owners of sports clubs, but we can't do it for folks that are living in tents on the street. I don't care if you're a Democrat.
Why doesn't that happen?
Well, it's twofold. Sometimes people use the slippery slope argument, and my environmental friends, and my environmental creds are as good as anybody in this state, say, oh, if you touch CEQA, one day you're going to take away clean water, clean air. I'm like, no, things that are legitimately about the environment, keep that in place. But something that allows somebody to sue on land use for 2 to 3 years, and even if they lose, they've killed that project, means that there are more homeless people. Let's be real about this. Let's be honest about it. And let's change not CEQA, but the CEQA abuse. So it comes from them, organized labor, who benefits most sometimes from building things, has used that as a way to hold projects back. And I think we've got to get over that as well, because we need a pipeline of future workers, and that comes from future work. The next downturn, we're going to be bending over backwards to try to do the CEQA reforms, I think. Now is a really good time. The last person to try to do this was Daryl Steinberg when he led our state Senate. I've talked with Gavin Newsom about that. Who I've supported for governor and who I believe is going to win. And really, I think this should be the ambition of this next agenda, of this next legislature, is to accelerate how quickly we can build housing in California. The California dream will die if we don't build enough housing. I mean, people came here because of good schools, good jobs, and cheap housing. Got to fix our schools, continue that upward trajectory. We've still got good jobs, thankfully, but we need to find more for the middle class. And I'm guaranteeing you, if we do not build housing in California, this will turn into a playground for the wealthy, but a barbell state of folks who are doing very well on the top and those who service them on the bottom and not much in between.
Well, and here in the Bay Area, a lot of restaurants and hotels are having a hard time finding people to hire because folks can't afford to live here, so they're moving to Modesto or even further away. I mean, it's just a real labor shortage.
And density is a really important piece of that. I think in Los Angeles, we did something really innovative where we set around all of our transit stops, we would dramatically upzone, higher, denser. And you can go even higher and even denser if you build affordable units for the folks at the very bottom who are most in danger of becoming homeless. In a year, we have about 6,000 units that have been put through the city's planning process. 1,000 of them, without any taxpayer dollars, are subsidized for low-income individuals, including 30% of those for the poorest people that we have in our city. Those sorts of policies, I mean, cities are such exciting platforms. And the tools that we have to be able to zone our way, to be able to legislate our way to solve those problems, it's time for us to step up and be a little bolder in this entire state.
We have a governor's election coming up, and Gavin Newsom's slogan is courage, period, for a change.
Right.
He just recently added the period. Jerry Brown has been courageous on a lot of things.
Yes, he has.
Including climate change, for one, and criminal justice reform, I would say, as well. But what would you like to see different from the next governor?
I'd like to see, I think housing and homelessness is the big place where Sacramento has been missing in action. And we've seen some incremental pieces the last couple of years. We've got two very important ballot measures, Prop 1 and 2, that will be on the ballot to provide more funding for affordable housing. But I remember sitting down, because I led that big 11 group of mayors with Governor Brown in his office, and I brought up the issue of homelessness. And he said, well, that's a local issue. I said, no, a Republican mayor in Fresno, Republican mayor in San Diego, Democratic mayor in Long Beach, Democratic mayor in Oakland, myself, this is all our number one issue. And we really need leadership from Sacramento, getting it easier to build, subsidizing more affordability, getting services to people who are experiencing trauma on our streets so we can get them housed, get them off of drugs, deal with their mental health issues, et cetera. That's number one, two, and three for me. I think secondarily, I'd like to see in Gavin's leadership a real focus on the future. One of the frustrations I have nationally in this last election, we didn't have people talking enough about the future. There's some really good ideas Hillary Clinton had about the future, but not a broad vision. Bernie Sanders had kind of a bold backwards vision of kind of how to give people greater opportunity, and Donald Trump was all backwards looking. We have a steam engine Washington right now in a jet age. We have folks who are not confronting the fact that by 2022, 52% of work will be done by machines. And we have to have, I think, a governor who really looks at those key industries for the growth of the middle class. And I haven't seen that vision.
Yeah. You mentioned Washington, so that's a good segue. You've been to Iowa. You've been to New Hampshire. You've been to Ohio. You've been to South Carolina. You're exploring a run for president. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. But most of those trips, in fairness, have been my work. I did them long before I was even thinking about president. So I'm going to Mississippi this weekend, for instance, in Oklahoma. Those aren't exactly big presidential places. I do believe in bringing this network of local leaders together and helping states out in particular that have been abandoned.
So what are you hearing from people?
I hear two things. One, that the false division of two Americas between the East Coast and the West Coast, the coastal areas and the heartland, urban, rural, red, blue, that's false. I do hear a second thing, that there are two Americas, and it's Washington and the rest of us. Washington and local communities. Local communities where we still connect with each other, where we respect each other, where we're decent to one another, where we argue about things, but we try to work them out. And Washington, where that's not what's on the scorecard. It's how many tweets and retweets, how much can you yell back, how can you invent problems and then not solve them, versus here, you don't have that luxury. You can't fake whether you've filled a pothole or not. It is concrete, literally, whether you do or not. And as I talk to folks, they hunger for a better America. They hunger for an America that is decent, that is forward-looking, and that unifies us. And I think what I hear out there is people are sick and tired of the politics of division, and that we have a Republican Party right now and president defining their success by what they can take away. Take away our protections of our environment. Take away our health care. Take away our tax protections. Take away our immigration protection. Take away our voting rights, for God's sake. I mean, I haven't heard this president actually utter the words that he's for democracy. I mean, I don't know a president that hasn't done that before. And so, but on the flip side, I don't hear them saying, oh, I want to just go, and yell at them all day long. I want leadership that isn't just about yelling back. I get upset. But we also see the dead end of that. The Kavanaugh hearings were so depressing last week. I worked on Anita Hill to help her as a college student. I helped bring for a professor I was working for a lot of the African-American men professors and women professors around the country in support of her. And we went down to Washington. And I felt kind of this trauma of last week because that was so deeply embedded in the work I had done when I kind of came of age politically. And that was the first most depressing thing, to see this 27 years later happening again to this woman. But second, I was almost as depressed by the way senators treated each other, that we've lost a space to be Americans. And it seems dead and gone now. We're lionizing people like John McCain, who many of us as Democrats probably vehemently disagreed with, as this saint and as such a decent person because he once in a while would cross over. I mean, the bar is so low now that what I hear in America is people want an America back that includes all of us.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
You mentioned alluded to the fact that one of the things this brings up is that when women come forward, they're not believed. you know, there are questions about, you know, whether they had some role in asking for it or, you know, why don't they remember? And something similar has happened with the church, Catholic Church. And we've seen now lawsuits in San Diego Diocese, elsewhere. Pennsylvania convened a grand jury to look at abuses there. Would you like to see the Attorney General, Javier Becerra, do what New York and New Jersey seem to be doing and have an independent, convene a grand jury and really get to the bottom of this stuff?
I've done a lot of work in my career looking at countries that deal with all sorts of trauma, apartheid in South Africa and truth commissions. My experience is always you have to put all that truth out there. You have to name names, even if it's past statute of limitations. We can't heal as a country if we don't live up to the mistakes and the trauma that have been committed inside our borders by whomever, because it allows tomorrow's trauma to go quiet. You care about the issue of homelessness. 91% of women who are on our streets are survivors of domestic and or sexual violence. You can't confront homelessness if you don't confront this issue. You can't confront the wage gap if you don't confront this issue. You can't confront the ongoing cycle of violence and the way that people re-traumatize, those who have been traumatized, sometimes become the abusers. You can't go to death row without seeing that almost 100% of them grew up in families of violence, of sexual and or domestic violence. Josh Shapiro, the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, is a dear friend of mine, and he was so brave with what he did. And I think, absolutely, there shouldn't be a jurisdiction where we don't do that. And it's painful, and people kind of say, well, didn't Pennsylvania do that? But there are people here right now who live with that quiet pain. And maybe they've spoken up, maybe they've talked to a friend, but there is something that we owe them so they can have their lives in saying that this happened. We are collectively sorry that it happened, and that we will demand justice where we can still for what happened to them.
You mentioned death row, and you know Jerry Brown has, and the voters have done a lot in terms of criminal justice reform. Prop 47, you know, reduced a lot of drug crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. Prop 57 allowed more people to get out of prison. Jerry Brown has allowed more lifers to get out of prison, I think, than all the past governors combined, probably by not reversing the recommendations of the parole board. Some people say, well, and look what's happening. You know, property crimes are going up. We've done too much. We need to put on the brakes. You know, what are your thoughts about that? Now we have bail reform also.
I think they're both right. I'm a big supporter of the idea that somebody shouldn't go away to jail for 20 years because they had a gram of something too much and their skin color was the wrong color. At the same time, if you don't do criminal justice right, you're making a big mistake. And I think that the implementation has been extremely flawed. Because the promise we were all sold is, hey, we're not going to spend your taxpayer money putting people away and spending $100,000 a year for them to be in prison. Those savings will come into programs that will rehabilitate them, take them off of drugs, train them for jobs. The experience in San Francisco, the experience in Los Angeles, is that people get out, if they serve any time now, who are deeply ill, and there is nothing to catch them. And there's no longer any stick with the carrot. I was in Jerry Brown's office when he was confronting then acting mayor or interim mayor of San Francisco, Mark Farrell. He said, I was driving around in San Francisco and I saw people with syringes hanging out of their arm. And I looked at the mayor of San Diego, who's a Republican. And I never felt, I was like, do you want to say it? Or do you want me to say it? Because I think it was the flawed implementation of this that has caused, I know as a city and as a mayor, you know, a lot of arrests don't get made around drugs. If they're made, there's no prosecution. If there's prosecution, there's no sentencing. And without that, how do you tell somebody you can either go into rehabilitation or be incarcerated? That doesn't mean we have to go back to 20 years, but with nothing there, you get chaos. And so I do think we need to revisit that and do it better. We should have done 2 or 3 years of setting up a safety net to catch people, have the best programs inside our jails for mental health and anti-addiction. So by the time they leave, they have a plan for job training, for education, expunging records, all of that. But instead, it's kind of like, hey, we did the politically correct thing because we all agree somebody shouldn't go away for 20 years, but we didn't really implement the other work.
You mentioned syringes. The governor just vetoed a bill that would have allowed San Francisco to have and maybe other cities or counties, but to have a pilot project where they would have supervised injection sites, and he vetoed that. Was that a mistake?
I think so. I think it's proven public health that it is better to have places where people can do this safely and get treatment than what we essentially said is, okay, you'll now do it out here. with no treatment, with no intervention, with nobody who gets to know who you are. It's a really tough political sell. I know that's not politically popular to say that. Most people don't, but I've always said, whether it's needle exchange programs that we have for safe needles or places where we have that privately in Los Angeles, that's really critical. If we want to get serious about ending an opioid crisis, you have to figure out a way where people can be. It's the same reason we need to house people with low barriers to entry in our shelters and let them stay there. Not shoot up in shelters, but if you're high or you're drunk, you should be able to come in, because otherwise you're just serving the easiest to serve anyway and saying the rest of them are going to be on the streets.
One bill the governor did sign, which I believe also applies to LA County, is this idea of expanding conservatorship.
Yes.
And allowing counties to compel people who are on the streets with severe mental illness into treatment.
It's absolutely the right thing to do. And I was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when I was in high school, so I understand how far bad it was in the 50s and the 60s. But this isn't, again, let's not use a slippery slope argument. This is not people just being able to pluck folks off the street that they decide are crazy and putting them away forever. We know that it has been such a high bar. They literally have to be harming themselves physically or harming somebody else. I was just talking, Polly Perrette, the actor from NCIS, is a friend, and she, as many people may have remembered, a couple years ago was attacked. She's a big homeless activist, but in her own neighborhood was attacked and nearly murdered by somebody. That guy was out and just this past week stabbed a police officer in the face. And he saved other people's lives by confronting him. But there are folks who we know that are out there. We know they sleep in one place for like 40 days without moving. They're deeply mentally ill, and we need to find a way to get them help. That is not humane to keep them out there.
Yeah. Police community relations, and I'm mindful, I want to make sure we get to some of these audience
Absolutely.
Questions. That's a big issue, and I believe the LAPD recently got 7,000 body cameras. Mm-hmm. There was a philanthropic donation to pay for those. How is that going? And the governor also just signed a bill to make videos from those cameras more accessible to the public. It raises a lot of complicated issues.
It's been great. So 5 years ago, I became mayor. In the first month, we raised some of that money and then put the rest in from the city budget. So every patrol officer, biggest city in America to do that, have had that. It's been great for accountability for those officers. It's been great in their interactions with the public, because certain folks, now knowing they're filmed, also de-escalate. But it can't be in a vacuum. We've also done de-escalation training for every single officer, expanded mental health training for every single officer, and done implicit bias training, which was a really tough thing to sell at first. But every officer I've talked to who's gone through it loved it, where you have to kind of confront, oh, maybe I do deal differently with folks who are different, and what can I do to be aware of my own biases and correct them. We also share our video data and have a policy of that. And that's really painful, traumatic things to see, police shootings, but it's the right thing to do. And I'm very proud.
How do you share it?
We share it. We have an initial review if there's a case that's coming, have a delay, but usually 30 days later, we release that for not anything that any cop does, but the ones where there's a shooting or a negative, high profile interaction that is given to the public, it's given to the press, it's given to everybody to see. And that transparency is absolutely critical. We've seen an over 20% drop in police shootings this past year. So all of these things, I think, you know, Los Angeles is in some ways much further ahead, because long before camera phones, we had Rodney King and a videotape. So we're not better than other places. We just went through it earlier. We have a police commission, an inspector general. We have, you know, the sort of independence, which doesn't mean we don't have bad shootings or we don't have cops that make mistakes. We just have a system to deal with it quite well, and a great training for our officers to really know that you don't have to always draw a weapon. And now next thing we're looking at is what technology for less than lethal force can we do in this day and age, so that a gun isn't always drawn, because often tasers aren't working. It escalates, and then, you know, somebody with a knife, it's in policy, gets shot and killed, but could we have saved that person's life?
I'm sure a lot of people know that your dad, Gil Garcetti, was the DA in LA County, served a couple terms, and I believe you were in college or maybe out of college after he got elected. Of course, one of the things he's known for was not getting OJ convicted. He got reelected the year after that, but then he lost in 2000 in part because of the Ramparts scandal controversy with the LAPD. Right. What did you, you were an adult then. I'm not sure where you were in 2000 exactly, but, you know, back what did LA. You take from that loss?
Well, I love my mother and father. They're amazing parents, and it was interesting to watch because somebody that you know goes into the public light and they have a certain reputation. Like my dad, some of you will recall the video where he's like, "Turn yourself in, OJ." And everybody's like, "Oh, your dad's a tough ass. Like he's a badass." And I'm like, "No, he's a loving, caring, hugging guy." And I realize that people only see slices of who you are, and it's really important to share more of your humanity. The second lesson was he taught me, look, know that your time in office, just do what you think is right, because hopefully you'll leave on your terms, but maybe you won't. And I had started running for city council as he lost by a 2-to-1 margin. And I was never running on his name, but I certainly didn't want to lose on his name. And the best thing that happened was he started going door to door in my campaign, and I did a lot of walking as well. And he said, I never had that experience before. And I got to actually meet people at the door because LA County's so big, 10 million, you can't do precinct walking. And I would get to doors where people said, I hated your dad, but tell me why I should vote for you. And they were really fair and I could win them over. Or other people who said, I love your dad, but why the hell should I vote for you? And it really taught me democracy is one person, one interaction at a time. And if you're willing to share yourself and be open and honest, you know, I think... I still believe, I'm a big D Democrat, but I'm a very strong small D Democrat. I really do think it's the best system that we have.
Well, let's democratize this conversation a little
Absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely.
We've got a lot of questions. It's always hard to kind of just grab one, but here's one. What items in recent news give you hope?
Oh, gosh.
Take as much
time
as
you don't read the national section, first of all. Just don't do that. I think... You know, traveling the country, I see all sorts of really hopeful stories. I see in Youngstown, Ohio, when I was there, which was steel mill central, and so many steel mills had closed down. That's one of the two top 3D printing manufacturing facilities in the country. In Waterloo, Iowa, next to the John Deere factory, where John Deere tractors have been made for decades, is the other one that's the best in the country. I see incredible hope, great news stories of, you know, we just opened up a new bridge housing facility in Los Angeles where the city was born in, near Alvera Street, where there's 45 beds for folks that have been camped there. And, you know, a good news story is the guy who was out there for 20 years on the street. And he said he preferred to be out there until his best friend went into board and care and with really sore bones, sleeping on the street. It was the first time he'd been in a bed in 20 years and he just cried talking about it. There's good news everywhere if you listen. There's a lot of bad news if you want to. And unfortunately, media usually distills the bad news. But I see hope all around the city. I see it in the time, you know, when I would serve in the military and we come together as people from every background. The first time we had training for the change in people being able to serve openly gay, it was kind of, oh, this is one of those chapters of history, like that you read about and you get that book. Like one day slavery did end. Like someone was there to witness it. And I'm witnessing now that LGBTQ folks can serve in the military, at least hopefully still with this president, but that we got that. So I think there's good news all the time. I'm a relentless optimist. I couldn't do what I do if I didn't see that. And I also think the last thing I'll say, just on a political, more partisan basis, is I'll tell you some good news that's coming. We have the most talented group of people running for Congress that I've seen in my life. I see a blue wave coming. People say blue waves don't happen automatically. I'm from California. I beg to differ because we get blue waves automatically all the time, crushing off our coast here. But we have a pink wave coming of incredible women who are running. I think we have a black wave coming where we're going to see African-American governors in states where we didn't imagine, including maybe the first African-American woman governor in Stacey Abrams in Georgia. I mean, to me, that's good news, just that we are a country that we might read the news and say, oh my gosh, we've stepped back so far. Well, only if you only read that. But if you're out there campaigning and looking at people who are stepping up and being active, there's a ton of good news coming.
Speaking of political activism, I mean, LA County has one of the lowest rates of voter turnout,
yes,
I think.
Yes.
I mean, your election, re-election, you got 81% of the vote, but I think it was less than 15% of people turned out.
No, it was over 20, but it was like 20, 21.
So too low.
Yeah, way too low.
Yeah. So why is that, do you think? And what, I mean, California has lowered, unlike a lot of states, has lowered every barrier to registering and voting. So what more needs to happen?
Across America, local elections have that low turnout. I mean, you get as low as 8% in some of them and maybe as high as in the 30s. We're changing our election date to be the same as our state elections. So I think we'll see that boost up to 60, 70% next time around. It's too bad because when you do it on the odd year, you get more attention and it's cheaper for people to run because you don't have to compete against presidential and gubernatorial candidates. But I think it's the right thing to do and maybe more should. And we should be mailing ballots to every single person. We should just be mailing them automatically like Oregon and other places do. We will pilot that, I know, here in the state, but we should be doing that for local elections. Make voting easy. Do it on the weekends. Tuesday was Women's Wash Day, which is why, you know, we had that as voting day because women weren't voting and men could go do that. It's so outdated technologically. We could make this a lot easier. But, you know, even in California, where we don't have the forces of other states that are trying to actively suppress the vote, I think we could step up a lot more.
Another question. Why do you think you will make a good president of the United States?
If I decide to run, you know, I bring...
Is that from one of your staff?
No, it's not. Yeah, they're asking, why would you? I hope, whether I run or not, that there are mayors that do. Most countries, mayors often become the heads of state, and it's an executive position. You know, I've learned as a mayor all about infrastructure. And the same night Donald Trump was elected, mayors helped pass $230 billion of infrastructure around this country. And Washington, after 2 years of talk, can't pass even $200 billion. I know international trade because I run the largest port in the nation. I know I was with dock workers yesterday opening up a new hiring hall, and I know the impact and how important that is. And I travel the world, met with 25 heads of states. I was just with the Prime Minister of Spain, who was in town on last Friday, talking about international trade. We know homeland security. We have a vision, I think, of a country that's inclusive. And we're people who are in the work of doing things, of bringing people together, and the toughest work from homelessness to solving traffic to building housing that this country needs to confront, I think, is done by cities. I also bring a wealth of experience internationally, not just for 12 and a half years as a Navy intelligence officer, but a former professor of international relations and somebody who really, you know, I went after the Olympics and won the Olympics and Paralympics for America. That was the longest campaign with the smallest number of voters that was the most intense politics, 4 years. And we really had to articulate what America wanted to be in order to get folks who were questioning us in the midst of President Trump being elected of why they should give this great global asset to our country. And I still believe in the America that the world loves to love and that we all still have in our hearts. And I see it every single day. And I just think that Washington is so out of touch. So whether I run or not, I do hope that, mayors who run entities bigger than many states and who have that experience of day-to-day unifying folks will be in this fight. And the last thing is I want certain ideas I'm not hearing out there of how we transform and win that future. I don't want a backwards or reactive-looking campaign. That's just why Donald Trump is a bad person. That's not a vision of what will be good. That's not a vision of what will work in the future. How do we take the libraries of America, for instance, which every rural and urban community have in the poorest zip codes and the most you know, faraway places, and turn them into incubators because there's space and there's good broadband? How can we have the worst infrastructure for communication, transportation, and energy in the developed world? How can our education system, when we need a college degree so badly, be so expensive, 81% more expensive than when I went to college adjusted for inflation, whereas in LA when we made community college free, as I mentioned, 40% more people were able to go to college. I want to hear those things that I think most Americans are talking about. I want to fight those fights on the Supreme Court, on, you know, impeachment, corruption, all that stuff. That's important. I don't dismiss those. That's our democracy. But most Americans wake up saying, who is concerned with my problems? And I think mayors know that and wake up with that.
There's a big debate in the Democratic Party, as there often is, about, you know, it's sort of in a lazy way. It's, well, it's the Bernie people versus the Hillary people. But it's really about, what is the vision of the party? Yeah. Is it more of a progressive, single-payer healthcare advocacy, that kind of thing? You know, or is it more central, like sort of in the political spectrum?
I think it's the wrong question. I'll say it in a different way. I think it can't be incrementalist. It has to be bold because the things we confront are huge right now. In the world, our alliances, the changing trade that we have, the automation of jobs. You know, we have a lot of excitement about those things and a lot of anxiety. I call it anxitement together. And I think every day we're kind of stressed by it, but we're seeing no leadership come around. most people don't wake up and say, I'm a proud progressive. I've raised the minimum wage, made community college free, invested in infrastructure, was fighting for LGBT rights before many were. I lead the climate mayors group and have 400 cities who have pledged to do Paris. I can go toe-to-toe on that if you're a spectrum person, but I've never met people who are really that. They don't go, give me 20 things. Okay, you're an 18.2. I'm a 17.9, but close enough, and that guy's a 26.8. For president, okay, you both are kind of somewhere in the realm of me listening. Do I like you? Do I trust you as a leader? Or do I want him?
Or her.
Or her. And that is going to be the most important thing. Yeah. I think Democrats have to start speaking plain English, have to connect with people, have to show their record of getting things done, and have to be bold. Have to be bold on healthcare, bold on immigration, bold on the environment. Don't keep doing incrementalist stuff. I disagree with my friend Bill Clinton, who said that the age of big government is over. What that did is it diminished people's ambition. And it's always been in this country, whether it's the internet or the interstates, government has been the driving enabler of our freedom, of our prosperity, and of our rights. And I see a Washington that is completely backed away from that.
On a completely different topic.
Yes.
thank you for declaring Morrissey Day in Los Angeles. Yeah. What is this?
Where's the Morrissey fan there?
What does his work mean to you? And I'm not a big Morrissey fan. Like, so yeah, why did you do that?
Well, before it was goth, I was kind of a death rocker in high school. So Morrissey, Bauhaus, Susie and the Banshees, that was my sweet spot. So I had to declare Morrissey Day, because if you can't use your power as mayor for something good. But, you know, I think he's been, you know, a leader in talking about, you know, cruelty towards animals. He's been really a leader in the humane space. I just like his music. And what's been cool to see in Los Angeles is the diversification of his fan base. I kind of love this in LA, and I think it's happening increasingly. But we have African-American kids that are obsessed with K-pop, and Latinos who are just in love with Morrissey. And it's nice to see those things when we're told, oh, we all only live in our tribes, that actually show that we're part of one human family. And I think Morrissey is a good reminder of that.
You mentioned, you alluded to your being a jazz pianist.
Yes.
Or pianist. Do you play?
I mean,
like, when do you play? What do you play?
I have a piano in my office, an upright piano, so I'll play between appointments. I like to improvise, kind of like Keith Jarrett, and play standards. Moby is playing at the LA Philharmonic this coming week, and he's invited me to play along with him, so I'll see if my schedule allows. I love music. I come from a family of musicians. It is, to me, the other side of my brain. I can work all day long on policy stuff, but just to float away by listening to a good song or playing one. And I love composing. To me, that's what I'd be doing if I wasn't in politics, and maybe one day I'll go back to it.
Maybe you could play the piano at the Iowa State Fair.
There you go. We have it.
While you're eating, you know,
a pork
butter,
chocolate.
Fried butter,
right.
Whatever it is they
fried
eat.
Fried butter.
They have it. They do have it. Let's see. What do you think are the most promising policies and invitations to address poverty in L.A., California, and the U.S.?
No question, raising the minimum wage. Just to give you the stats, we have about $3.4 million per working hour more in the pockets of 640,000 minimum wage earners. So that's 640,000 families. There's no question that that has been the biggest anti-poverty policy that we've faced or ever passed. Second is community college, which I've mentioned, but I'll be a broken record about that. We should have free community college in this country, just full stop. And I'm glad that we did 1 year, and then the state did a year, and then we went 2 years. Now the state's looking at 2 years. I'm so glad to live in a state where we've said that and we focused on that. Third is we've got to connect people. Last night I was with a group of young people, about 80 of them, that are part of something called the Evolve Entertainment Fund, which I founded to help young women, young students of color, or just poor students connect with the entertainment industry. Time's up, Oscar's so white, we've heard all that. This is key industry in my town. And there's always been good intentions. It's a liberal industry. But the stories of young people from certain zip codes who grew up in the shadow of Hollywood just haven't been there. And so we've more than tripled the number of youth jobs in the summer. You want to end poverty in this country, end social isolation for people who grow up without knowing somebody, without being able to get that internship. And now we're finding mentors for all of them. That's what last night's event was. And we're doing this across many industries. And I think if we had an America that opened up the doors to connect people through education, but also through an internship and job training system like we see in places like Switzerland or Germany, where while you're in high school, you get to work in places. Government pays for the education, private industry pays the wages, and people can actually get a taste of that. We've got too many kids living in rural areas in America, the wrong state, or the wrong zip code in an urban environment, who just don't know anybody to help them reach their dreams, and that's un-American. Yeah.
We are almost out of time, and somebody from the club, tell me if I'm wrong about that, but we have 7 minutes left. Thanks, George.
There's a clock up there.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. Good. Let's see. L.A. is a cultural leader in the world. It's also the single largest cannabis market at over $1 billion.
Yes, it is.
I commend you for a point. Well, let's leave that out. Let's see. How do you envision supporting the framework so that has affected by the war on drugs? Sorry. Business leaders in California and beyond. So, you know, sort of implementing this new law and seeing that, you know, there's some equity in the way it's implemented, I guess.
So we think we had the boldest policy in the country to not just enable a responsible cannabis market, keep cannabis out of the hands of kids and do things in a responsible way, but also to bring social equity into this and racial equity into this, because the communities that were preyed on in the war on drugs, we actually have codified that if folks are opening cannabis enterprises in Los Angeles and come from certain zip codes, racial backgrounds, even criminal records of certain types, that they can have fees waived, they can have lower barriers to entry. And it was interesting when we opened up the permitting process, over, I think, 80% of the permits were from out-of-state corporations. They saw LA was the biggest market, and so from Las Vegas and from other states, people were coming, and we wanted to make sure we build wealth in communities that have suffered the most. Mm-hmm. And Kat Packer, who's the head of the Department of Cannabis Regulation, if you told me 20 years ago we'd have a Department of Cannabis Regulation, I wouldn't have believed you. But she has done a remarkable job of really bringing that piece in, and we hope LA will be a model for other places, that it isn't just about health and safety and access. It's also about righting the wrongs of the past.
All right, another audience question. Despite the high-tech movie industry in LA, the differences remain high in I should have put my glasses on. tech development. How can entrepreneurs in high-tech be supported in LA?
So this was one of the main things I did when I came into office. I wanted to restore our basic city services, build out infrastructure for the next 50 years, and focus on key industries. And tech was one of them. We now have more tech jobs in LA County than any county in America. It's a very diverse tech industry. So it's not just digital technology, which of course you have so brilliantly up here, but we have aerospace, we have biotech, we've got food tech, we've got video game tech, we've got entertainment tech. So, you know, engineers can go between many different sorts of industries. And I put a focus on that we had the largest job fair in the Western United States, if not the United States. And it looked as diverse as our city, by the way. Over, I think, 14,000 young people lined up to work for companies like SpaceX, the city of LA, new startups, Soylent, you know, companies that are working in all sorts of different spaces. And to me, that's been very important. It goes back to my earlier answer. We've got to connect people with those opportunities, and we've done it very consciously. So our libraries, for instance, have STEM programs after school that we started. A majority of the people in them are women, are girls. Mm. If you don't do that intentionally, it doesn't happen. Gender equity, you know, this is straying a little bit from the tech question, but a majority of our commissioners in the city of Los Angeles for the first time are women. My chief of staff, half of our deputy mayors, we had 99 cents on the dollar. Maybe it's a dollar to the dollar now on our wage gap inside my own office. Like, you have to be intentional about these things. And if government acts so slow, my message to the private sector, who oftentimes doesn't have a single woman or a person of color on their boards or in the C-suites, if government can do that in 6 months, make 50% of the commissioners women who run the airport, the port, the police department, et cetera, why can't you?
Yeah. We are just about We are just about out of time. You know, San Francisco, and this it's a little less true now that Herb Cain is no longer with us, but, you know, Herb really fueled this rivalry between Los Angeles and San Francisco. We see it in the Dodgers and the Giants, which I think everybody enjoys, maybe now the Lakers and the Warriors, now that you have LeBron. But I've often wondered, do people in L.A. care about that?
You want my honest answer? Growing up in L.A., yeah, I went to school in New York. Like I said, New Yorkers would always rag on L.A. I'd come up here, and I'd kind of get the teasing and the jokes about L.A. I'd go down to San Diego. They used to call us Smell-A in the smoggy days. And Angelenos were kind of like, ah, that's cool. Like, I've never felt the rivalry back. I love the Bay Area. I love San Diego. I loved living in New York. I think we were always kind of comfortable in our own skin, and if people didn't want to come, we were happy with our own little secret. L.A. has matured, though, in, I think, coming into its own. You know, it's interesting this happened around the Olympics. 1932, when we won the first Olympics, the Olympics said, can we give that to that city that's the suburb of Hollywood? They literally didn't even know where L.A. was, and we kind of became a global city then. In 84, I would argue we kind of became a great global city. The people were like, oh, okay, Tom Bradley was our mayor and known around the world, and we invested in things that, you know, finally gave us a subway, et cetera. I think by 2028, 10 years from now, as we look at all the investment that's coming to LA, all the museums that's opening, the art scene, the technology jobs, the kind of cutting-edge way we're looking at planning a city for the next 50 years, that will be one of those indispensable global cities. We're the third largest economy in the world now of any city. So Tokyo's number one, New York's number two, and we're number three just behind New York with almost $1 trillion of I call it MP, gross municipal product. And we're 22nd in population. So if you put that together with a population, we're the most productive population on the face of the earth of any metro area. But we don't brag about those things. You know, I think that surprises folks because we're kind of seen as maybe that the always number two to New York, number two to the Bay, number two. But we, I think, love what we have. And the last thing I'll say is I hope that everybody embraces LA as an American city. 40% of the goods that come into this country come through our port. We have the number one origination and destination airport in the country now, number two in air traffic. You know, Hollywood is an American product, not a Los Angeles product. When the Olympics come, we're going to do stuff up here with you too. Trust me, we'll have events or qualification. We want people to embrace this because LA is kind of what New York was in the 20th century. It is that gateway, that northern capital of Latin America, western capital of the United States, eastern capital of the Pacific Rim. It displaced New York to London as the most significant air corridor in the world, transoceanic, 2 years ago, and that's never going to change, I think, in our lifetimes. So we love you. We'd love it if you love us too.
Okay. Our thanks to Mayor Eric Garcetti for joining us today. We also thank our audience here on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Scott Schaefer of KQED, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is closed.
Thank you.